The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on June 2, 2024. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Morning. Good to see you all today. If you go to a Zen monastery outside the Zendo, they'll have there's a big block of wood hung by a thick, heavy rope, and then beneath a rope that you hold, and then with a big wooden mallet, you hit the block. It makes a big sound, penetrating sound that goes far. And on that block is written various things, but a common one is Dogen's phrase, "Impermanence is swift." Just a kind of a reminder. You pound on that block, and the tradition is then gradually, maybe you go through several mallets, but eventually that big block of wood, big, heavy, thick block of wood, gets pounded through and it'll break apart. And then you put up a new one. And you take the pieces from the one that finally shattered, and you burn them in a rather interesting ceremony. Interesting feature of Zen, I guess. An important reminder. And when we come to study Buddhism, you know, we're reminded of this swiftness of life and the suddenness can be of death, that it is surely coming, anyway, the certainty of it, that things come and go, that everything is impermanent. And it's not just we ourselves and our bodies, or that big heavy block of wood, or even the earth itself is impermanent, that everything is changing. Nothing is holding still. Nothing will last. And it isn't just the physical stuff of the world, which would include our bodies, but also our minds, thoughts, and feelings. We experience it even now. Even as you sit here already, can you count thoughts? Where do they start and end? But many thoughts have probably come and gone already for each one of us in our own mind. So not the floor or the windows, but everything, thoughts and feelings, understandings, misunderstandings, everything coming and going. So this is impermanence, we say, and we have this teaching of impermanence. And we might begin by just pointing out that everything is impermanent. And there isn't anything you can name or point to or think of that doesn't exhibit impermanence. You can search for this a bit. You might think, oh, there must be something. Yeah, well, in a sense, there's a reason for why we might think that, because it isn't that it's not exactly true, but you'll never find such a thing as that exhibits permanence, because everything is impermanent. Yeah, and that's a pretty good understanding, you know, that we might have when we believe in things and thoughts and feelings, and that they all, yeah, they come and they go. They seem to originate somehow. Sometimes, particularly like, say, with a thought or a feeling, exactly how does that originate? But even things, how do they come into existence, which is kind of persistence, and then they persist for a time. But no matter what it is, it will change, and then we think, and then it will go. And we never notice the inconsistency there, or the paradox of all of that. Then how can you have something that comes into existence, that persists for a time, and then it goes? So Nagarjuna points directly to this, that our understanding of impermanence, or Dogen's expression of impermanence, is swift. What exactly is he pointing to there? Well, you really can't get hold of it. That's what he's pointing to. We may get an idea of what this means. Oh, yeah, things come and go. I know, I won't last. Nothing does. Maybe there is that sweet by and by somewhere where we can go and abide forever. Yeah, that's an idea. Those ideas come and go too, and change. There isn't anything that forms in any way whatsoever that you can label or refer to, set it in opposition or relationship with other things, or thoughts or people or dogs or cats or trees. But whatever it is, it exhibits this impermanence. So everything is impermanent. But Nagarjuna points out that this is not really the full understanding of impermanence. Because he points out that nothing is impermanent. You can't single out anything at all that is impermanent. This is the correct understanding of impermanence. How is that? It doesn't seem to make sense at first, when we first encounter that. That teaching, well, Nagarjuna, he must be wrong. I mean, this is crazy. We have these things and everything is impermanent. And no, nothing is impermanent, says Dogen. So you mean it all lasts forever? No, because he'll tell you that nothing is lasting either. He'll point out that this impermanence that is actually life, but this impermanence is such, it is so thorough that there is no thing formed there in the first place to be impermanent. This is what he's drawing our attention to. And this is something we can see. We can just look at our experience, our daily experience, momentary experience, endlessly. It's just like this. You can't get hold of it. It's already gone. There isn't anything about this moment that seems to persist, or that will persist. We think so. Well, if we don't look at this carefully, we imagine all sorts of things are persisting, including me. We might then wonder, but also I'm changing. But how can you change and still be you? Well, and what's changing? Everything about it seems to be changing. You can't get hold of anything there that seems to be persisting. Whether it's the different cells of your body or the atoms that make up these cells or the thoughts and the feelings and the understandings that might be there. There is not one thing here that remains itself even for a moment, that then dies, that becomes, exhibits that impermanence. The impermanence is right there in the very vibrancy of life itself. It is life itself. It is of this nature. And we cannot really get hold of it. No more than we can get hold of the thing that has passed away and gone, so as it appears. But this is the nature of what we experience here directly. If we don't get ideas about it, if we don't get ideas of permanence, we will not see anything that is permanent. It is in our thinking and in our grasping and in the way we're putting the world together in our mind. I'm saying this for now. Maybe I can take this apart too before we're done today. I don't know. We'll see where this goes. but this is the actual experience, though, is this continuous stream and streaming. Far from that, it might strike us as being frightening or something when we're still thinking about myself or those I love, or, you know, we talk about impermanence. What we don't recognize, though, is this is freedom from any anxiety we might have about these comings and goings. But it is a matter of just simply seeing this. Well, it's interesting that somebody sent me a book recently. It's Vince. I don't know if you're out there, Vince, but the book you sent me is a book by Donald Hoffman. Well, he doesn't talk about this directly, what I've been speaking of so far, but he points out a few things that might bring out more of what I could say about what I've just said. Well, in this book, and I've studied Don Hoffman's writings before, and I didn't have this book, but I was very familiar with most of what was in the book. But in that book, well, Hoffman uses this image of a Necker cube. Do you know what a Necker cube is? So I brought this image in. Most people, I think, have seen this. Been around for a couple hundred years by the guy, I think he was a Swiss man who drew this Necker cube for the first time about 200 years ago or so. And Hoffman, what he's trying to show here in the book is how the stuff that we have here, well, he doesn't quite put it this way, but the way I was about to say, I'll let that go for the time being. He likens what we experience here to, he's using kind of the image of, say, objects that are appearing on a computer screen and how we can manipulate these objects to type our emails or whatever it is that we're doing. Then we put it in a folder or whatever, and it's sitting on the computer, and it's in a blue folder. But as he points out, the file or whatever it was that we did, it's not blue, and it's not sitting on the screen. And it's just a bunch of interrelationships that by manipulating these images on the screen and that sort of thing, all sorts of different switches are being thrown in the computer and this sort of thing. And that's doing all the work. And we're just playing with the things that are appearing on the screen. And so we can control those things. But what he's saying is that the reality, again, there's a problem with this I'm going to point out, though. But the reality that's behind all of those things that, you know, that we can manipulate and see, it's actually doing the work there and keeping the information or changing it or transmitting it or whatever else. But we don't have direct control of that. We couldn't, you know, the computer actually hides it from us. We're just using these things that we can see and understand. It's image of a folder, and you can open it up, and now you see the words, and then you can manipulate those things. But the actual manipulations and things going on behind the scenes there, and it's all utterly abstract, and we can't really get hold of it. And then he uses this image of a Necker cube here to kind of show how, which way is this thing facing. Well, for those of you who might be just hearing audio on this, you can look up a Necker cube on your computer, I think, and at least get some sense. I'll try to describe it in a way that maybe you can make sense of it. But say that this, what do we have? We have a square that's to the upper left, say, as you look at it this way. And he does a better job of this in his book. I has several images, but he'll make that square up on to the upper left as sort of the front of this cube. Now you can see it that way, and in that one that's to the, was it the lower right, I believe, yeah. And then that would be the back, and the cube looks like it's sitting a certain way. But then you can, in your mind, you can switch those images. You can make the one to the lower right, lower right. You can make that the front panel, you know, and then the other one becomes the back. But the point that he likes to bring out is to show that you can view it any way. It's not any particular way. And so in the end, which is it? When we look at just the Necker cube itself, what is it? Which panel is in front? Which panel is behind? Yeah, we'll see a cube. You know, it would seem that it would have to be one way or another. But actually, you can't get hold of the Necker cube itself to say that one is in front or the other is in back. You can say, well, it looks that way to me now. Yeah, I can see it this way. Then we don't quite see it the other way. But then our minds can switch, and suddenly we're seeing the other panel is in front. Are you following me on this? But what he's saying is, if you just look at this alone, there's not enough information in this image of this Necker cube to tell you which is the front and which is the back. And so the real Necker cube, which, you know, he'll have a picture of one where he's clearly talking about the front, and another one is clearly talking about what's the back. But when he shows you just the Necker cube itself, without giving any extra information like that, you don't have enough. And so then they talk like this, that your brain or something, your mind will make these switch. It'll switch in your mind, so the image will be appearing, you know, in your mind. And Hoffman, who's some kind of a, well, what is he exactly? I forget. But he's involved with perception. This is what he studies, you know, perception. And so he's talking about how we'll perceive it this way and then we'll perceive it that way. This is going to lock him into a dead end if he pursues that. Because this isn't perception. We don't perceive that at all. You don't perceive, well, the way I'm going to talk about this, and I would say the way the awakened might talk about this, we don't perceive cubes, we don't perceive Necker cubes, or just regular cubes, or people, or chairs, or we think, I perceive this cup. Well, to one who's awake, you realize that, no, you conceptualize that. We're dealing with what we can conceptualize, what we conceive, not what we perceive. And so now here's a guy who studies perception, but he's still using that kind of terminology, which will limit him and other people like him in that way. There's other folks, too, who have come to realize that the actual reality that's being lived out here is mental. The fundamental basis of this reality isn't matter, as probably most of us think. Most scientists probably think this way, or people that deal with the mind, and they think it's all housed in the brain, that there's matter, that's the substrate for all of this, and that everything is based upon. But then Hoffman himself, though, he quotes in that book, he has a quote by Nima Arkani Muhammad, and who's a one of several young guys now coming along. I don't know if he's a physicist, he's a mathematician for sure, but who have discovered that, well, that space-time isn't fundamental, isn't ultimately real. Space and time, we could think that, well, the objects here that occupy space and time, you know, we can start to question that it isn't really, you know, solid matter, whatever we discover the various elements that things are made out of, and we devise the periodic table and, you know, of elements and all of this, so we can, and we study these things. But the objects and the things that we study with these things are, here they are in physical space and time. And so this is what Nima Arkani Hamid said here. He said, many, many separate arguments, all very strong individually, suggest that the very notion of space-time is not a fundamental one. Space-time is doomed. Now, this is right on the frontiers. This has only been the last 10 years or so that they've discovered. He was one of the discoverers of the what they call the amplituhedron. I can say a little bit about that in a second. But because that's what space-time is made of. Anyway, that and other objects like that. But anyway, they say space-time is doomed. There is no such thing as space-time fundamentally. in the actual underlying description of the laws of physics. That's very startling, because what physics is supposed to be about is describing things as they happen in space and time. So if there's no space-time, it's not clear what physics is about. Now, this is by a guy who has really studied this very deeply. What he's saying is that the basis of our understanding of pretty much everything, certainly in science, not just the physical science, but even in mind sciences, which I could point to, I've been reading a lot of literature in this area for the last 30, 40 years now, and they keep making the same mistake. Well, most of the time, they just think that the basis of all of this is physical. Well, they're getting on the frontiers of this. They're getting to realize that even the physical that would seem to occupy space and time and can be manipulated and moved around in space and time, that space-time itself isn't a thing. It seems to be structured by these other things, one of which I happen to have the name of it, which is, it's called they call it the amplitudehedron. I have no idea. You know what a hedron is, maybe? But I have no idea what this would be. They don't either. And if they were to pursue that and check out each of these different things that seem to be giving us this impression that we have of space and time, and that it's filled with things here, well, they're going to find that those things too will be made of other structures. And those too will be made of other structures still. Why would that be the case? Because this is the way mind works. As the enlightened see this and understand this reality, this is how it works, is that for something to appear to be formed here, not in just the gross ways of like this building or just our bodies or and even our thoughts and feelings, that they're formed in some way, that in order for this to to occur in the way that we naively think that these things are occurring, well, they're made of something else that isn't them, but that come together in some way to exhibit, well, an object of various kinds, whether it's a mental, purely mental object or a physical one. But the error is in what the awakened might point out, what a Nagarjuna might point out for us, and it's not just these people, because we all do this. We all, the way I phrase it here, and I've used this in a lot of my teaching, you might have heard it from time to time, and this is what I'm talking about. You put something there. We have a strong tendency to put something there, because if we're conceptualizing the world and we're putting together everything out of our concepts, our ideas, our intellectual graspings, then you will never get to what is fundamental, what is truly there, so to speak. We can't even use that word now, because as Arkani Ahmed points out here, that we don't even have there. We don't have space-time, apparently. That itself isn't something. It's made of other things. But that's the nature of the conceptual, the conceived, the intellectually grasped. This is why the awakened at all occasions are telling us to let go of your views, your ideas, your intellectual grasp of this, of whatever it might be. This is what blocks us from really seeing and understanding the nature of reality. They would also say you don't have to let go in the sense that you don't make use of these things. They're very functional and useful, what we see or think or feel, or well, we can arrange things. We can use these in ways that are very painful and destructive. We can use them in ways that are very harmonious and helpful for people, and that are more comforting. And you know, so they can be used in all sorts of ways, but that's the nature of the world of objects of this and that, the conceptual, the things that are appearing to come and go, the things that are appearing to be impermanent, even though they seem to also persist without us really grappling with the real contradiction in that. and not realizing that the basic fundamental contradiction in our thinking or our putting together of the world, every once in a while we'll get a little whiff of this, and things will just seem so strange. And you know, well, it's coming from the fact that, yeah, it's because the way we put the world together in our minds is illusory. And we don't understand that. We don't see the illusion of it. We also don't, and these folks too, not just Hoffman, but, there's Bernardo Kastrup, and I talked recently, well, a while back, last winter, on Federico Fagin, yeah. And there's others. Spira, I think his name of one fellow. Anyway, there's a whole bunch of people like this who seem to be on the threshold of realizing that the basis of reality is mental and not physical. The physical is the way it's, the mental is kind of presenting itself. As physical, as well as purely mental as well. But this is how the awakened see it. And it's interesting, too, that in this book where Don Hoffman is talking about and making use of this Necker cube, he said, like, if you see it, with this panel's in front or that panel's in front, but you can't quite put them together because they won't go together into this same image exactly. What you see is, there's the Necker cube, and it doesn't really have a front panel and a back panel. Can't really say that there is one. And he'll say that he can't even really say that there's a Necker cube. Or we can't really say that there, he might not say it here in this context, but that there's a here or a there, as Arkani Muhammad has pointed out. But as Hoffman then says here, he says something is there. And this is where they go wrong. So far, everybody I've studied in these areas of mind science and all of this, and perception. And it's a mistake I made. Even after I understood this, I saw this, I realized it's just seeing what Nagarjuna calls emptiness. And this is many years ago now, when I saw that. And it was only when I went back to reading Nagarjuna that I realized, my God, that's what he's pointing to with this term shunyata, emptiness. But it was like nothing to say here, or so I thought for a long time. Though I wanted to say something, I wanted to help people to see this, because it's for each of us, you need to just directly see this yourself. And it isn't an idea, it's not an intellectual achievement of any kind. In fact, if you take too much pride and wallow too heavily in your intellectual achievements, you can make it very difficult for yourself to see that these aren't really holding anything. But it's interesting because in the book of Donald Hoffman here, where I took this stuff from, he says in a number of places that he said, well, but you can't say that there's, you know, a front to the Necker cube or a back or whatever. The Necker cube just isn't giving us enough information. But he said, and he'll even point out that there's no Necker cube as such. But he said, there's something there. It just isn't something that looks like a Necker cube. It isn't blue or yellow. It's, you know. Well, here we have Wang Po way back over 1,000 years ago is talking about the one mind. It's not green or yellow. It's not big or small. But he also says, Wang Po, over 1,000 years ago, there is only the one mind. The one mind. This is a one it's different. I would capitalize that one if I were writing it out. Because it isn't one as opposed to two or three or many. It isn't something like that. It's that just nothing other than this. There isn't any otherness as such. The otherness is what is appearing in the world of objects, in the world of coming and going, which the awakened don't dismiss. You can't. It's this apparent reality that we seem to be living in now. And we can't dismiss it. It isn't like You know, I'm not sitting here in front of you talking now. It's just that can't really say that. What is I even referred to? In my case, you will use that other letter, the single letter words, you. So you refer to me as you. I'll refer to you as you. But these I and you in this case, are you following? I'm trying to make a half of a joke there with this, but it's kind of like these single letter words, I and you. Anyway, but they get us into trouble because we think that we deeply think that they mean something. Well, that's me. And, you know, like, well, yeah. It's what? We can't get hold of anything. That's how we have this vibrancy, which is always thus. No matter what, with the appearances of the comings and the goings and the this and that and the here and the there, it is just simply thus. This is what Wang Po is speaking of, but there's only the one mind. I remember when I first was reading Wang Po, I could not understand him. But there was something in what he was saying that kept drawing me to him and Nagarjuna and others. But I was approaching it, as we all do, I think, in an intellectual sort of way, trying to get the idea, trying to grasp, what are these guys pointing to? I was starting to get the sense eventually, over a period of some years, I suppose, that they're really directing me to pay attention to the living it out, moment by moment. What's going on with this? But of course, there's still the grasping. Well, I seem to be doing it. We'll continue to put something there. And then when we do put something there, now we can speak of it and we can argue about it. Well, is that right? Does that hold up? Doesn't that contradict this? And then we get lost in those kinds of discussions. It's just endless with us. Of course, we can, well, look at our world today, politically, what's going on. And people arguing this and arguing that. Well, you can't possibly believe what you're saying. People will say that about you. And it's just endless with us. Totally wallowing in delusion and confusion. And yet we'll have firm convictions about this, and others will have it about that. The awakened do not see things like this. It isn't just the Necker cube that isn't any particular way. Nothing is any particular way. That's how we have it. If that were not the case, nothing would be going on. But clearly, that isn't the case. Nothing is going on. There's just this whole thing. And it is always, here's your permanence now. It is always thus. That's where impermanence is. And it's like with the one mind, there's just this one thing here that is permanent, thus. But of course, the problem is, I'm using words now and I'm creating an object. But that's just so I can talk or point, as these other teachers have done as well. Even though they're telling you, don't grasp anything I'm saying here now. Don't take hold, don't. Notice what do you think they're directing us to do? Pay very careful attention to your own mind. I tell you often, just watch your mind. I don't mean watch your mind and so you can get the right idea. I mean, notice how you're creating ideas, you're grasping ideas. You're thinking these ideas are better than that, or is this the right one, or is this what you mean by that? And all the time, that's what we're doing, and we're not paying attention. And this is all I really want to help you with. After I finally realized this, and I had a pretty fine job at the University of Minnesota here, you know, everything was nice, but I quit that. And I wanted to write about this. And I found that I couldn't really do it. I went pretty far. I had a couple of books there that got a few hundred pages into them. And I had these structures kind of doing like, well, what I see these guys are doing. And where Hoffman is saying that there's something there. But that's the mistake. Yeah, we don't have an anchor cube. It's not this, it's not that. Though there's something going. Well, I think all we need to see is that, yeah, this isn't nothing. That's it. Don't create something now. Don't put something there. Obviously, this isn't nothing. That's it. What is it in particular? Well, do you understand? There isn't anything there in particular. We have this whole thing, and it's very dynamic in it. Seems to go on, change. All that. That's the show. That is how it's unfolding. And we can live according to this. And the moral, or ethical moral, which are, at least in our society today, it's horribly lacking. But the moral implications of this are profound. I'm going to be talking, I think, in Duluth in a couple of weeks, and I'm thinking this might be what I'll be talking about. I won't give the background that I can give now in this talk, but to set this up. But because in this world of this and that and following these rules and what that person says or what this book says and thou shalt and thou shalt not and being ordering this, that is part of this confused grab bag of really non-real. Just this stuff isn't even real, what we'll argue about and fight over. So how do we live a decent life? This is kind of what I wanted to talk about a couple months ago when I gave a talk. I ended up calling it happiness, even though at the beginning I said I wasn't going to use the word. The word was eudaimonia, which I didn't use, and I won't use it now because it's a little difficult. But to lay it all out, I don't want to take the time. But it's about living in such a way that, and the ancient Greeks who came up with this, they never quite figured it out again because they always put something there. But to be living in such a way that is in complete harmony with the unfolding of this and that. And that word Tathagata fits into this. But then that gets misinterpreted by people who follow the Buddha way. They'll misinterpret the Tathagata and they'll insert the idea of one who has gone thus. Now you're putting one who has said, there's only the one mind, says Huang Po. There isn't some person, a Buddha, is a Tathagata, we could say. But that one who has gone, throwing that into a form like that, that's really not what's in those words. It's just simply thus. And then there's this appearing of trends of coming and going. Gata or Agata. And it's just, it looks thus, always thus. It isn't just Buddhas that appear in this way, but strictly speaking, Buddhas don't even really exactly appear. But the things that seem to be coming and going, they appear just simply thus, without an actual thing that's doing the coming and the going. This is what Nagarjuna is pointing out about that term, impermanence. That there's no thing but formed in the first place, but that is this life, that is this wonderful experience that is known to us directly. It is in our thinking, in our grasping, getting hold of this idea or that idea, not paying attention to the vibrant life that's being lived out. That's where the sorrow and the pain and the confusion come from. And trying to figure it out and then trying to do the right thing. If we see this all as it is, you don't have to worry about doing the right thing. Living in accordance with thus. So, but still, we'll want to put something there. We want to make the rule, you know, this or that. And in limited ways, these are helpful. Like in driving, we have rules of the road. Yeah, we should all follow those. If we all follow the rules, we should be able to accomplish our driving in very complicated ways. In large cities, you know, where a lot of traffic is moving here and there, and we can still do it without just constant bumping into each other and getting tied up in snarlments and traffic and whatever. So rules are, you know, very functional. And when it comes to that world of objects, of this and of that, the things that we conceptualize, we can't ignore this. It seems to be what we are. But yeah, we can make some rules here now. But ultimately, well, as the wise farmer said, can't really say what's good or bad. But if we follow the way that this is unfolding here, instead of looking at, and this is where the morality aspect comes from, instead of interpreting everything in terms of these hard and fast different things here, they're separate from the good and the bad, the good and the evil. That in itself is not harmonious. Yeah. And it doesn't give us eudaimonia. It gives us pain and misery, not happiness. So it's a matter of being very clear on this. There's a lot to say in that area, which I'm opening, but it won't be here, I don't suppose. Maybe I'll say something here eventually, I don't know. But there's a lot here that I'm trying to help you to notice. Yeah, and I was saying too, when I finally started to really understand this, but I realized I couldn't say anything. But for some reason, I thought maybe I could write this all out. And I made four attempts. Finally, my fifth attempt became my first book, How the World Can Be the Way It Is, which is not a very good title. The publisher gave it that title. It doesn't really fit the book. I'm not talking about the way the world is. But I am pointing out how the world can't be the way that we think it is. Yeah. But eventually what I realized too, in trying to do that, in trying to say how it is, and I the first couple of books I did that never published, but I had these elaborate forms and schemes, my theory, these hypotheses that I constructed, built some rather elaborate explanations for how this can be. And it was hard, but I get like 200 pages into it or something, and I realized this isn't it. I knew better. I knew that we can't say, that we can't put it into words. I even saw Nagarjuna demonstrating this in his Mula Majjhima Karika. He doesn't really say, because you can't, and he knows that. I knew it too. But I was more stupid and kept trying to do it. Eventually, I did write something. And there are things that we can say, that we can point out. But what we can't point out is the truth, is the way it is, because we'll just cheapen it. We'll just put it into a form. And now we can argue about it from different angles and things like this. And this is the one that belongs to the group that we might otherwise call the many. And it's grounds for fighting. It's grounds for not really understanding. It's grounds for having an uneasy heart and mind. But if we could just see, well, we don't grasp this. We live here in a world where some rules are functional and useful and helpful. Well, we could start to realize that we can turn our attention to the whole and not the individuated part. And with the whole, this is just with pure perception. The conceptual isn't functioning there. When I throw it into the conceptual, and now for us to have a conscious awareness of that, it has to have three dimensions, spatial dimensions, and there's time too. These all seem to combine, into an object that we call space-time, but that's not the fundamental. These mathematicians and physicists are now beginning to realize. Well, anyway, but this is I don't know how much of this I got across today. I'll just leave you with this: with the awakened, you see, you want to know, well, what do they say? How do they see this? Just realize that. They're not seeing this in a way that they can hand you. that they have an idea about this. This whole thing about consciousness, mind, and is it from the brain and all that? No, clearly this isn't what's taking place. It doesn't make any sense. I mean, and everything will fall apart sooner or later. We're going to hit dead ends. This all can be seen. And then if we just learn to, maybe through exhaustion, I think in my case, finally, I just gave up, especially trying to write a couple of books on these things, just kind of giving up with that, not even trying to actually spell it out, knowing full well that you can't. And then maybe you can say something. Okay, well, anyway, I better end it here. Any questions about anything I said here? Yeah, David.
If I'm driving down the street and I make a mistake and hit somebody, how does this apply to that situation?
It applies just as what you described. You drove down the street, you hit somebody, we could say, well, there's no you, there's no driving, there's no down the street. Yeah, we can say all these things. And that's what I'm kind of pointing out. None of these things have substantiality in and of themselves. But there is this world of appearances, this is where we live. The world of this and that, the world of coming, going, birth and death, all of this. So the way we take care of this is not to say, well, there is this and there is that, and you did hit this person and that. That's not going to get us very far. It's kind of like Buddha, when he used this metaphor or this story of talking about a man, say, who was shot with an arrow. And people were there to rescue him, to help him, maybe, you know, do whatever they could. Not necessarily pulling out the arrow, because that might not be the best thing, but they were there to help him. But before he'd let them do anything, he said, well, first I want to know, well, who shot that arrow, and, you know, what tribe did he belong to, and he had all these questions. And we'll do that. But the Buddha wouldn't talk about things like this. He said, well, immediately we have this situation, deal with it. You're shot with an arrow, a man here is shot with an arrow, immediately we take care of that. If you want to pursue these other questions later, that's something else again. And of course, just as I said, we need rules in our society, rules of the road, but all kinds of other rules too. And we can all agree with, as a society, I would hope, that these are the rules we should follow. Usually, if enough of us are making these decisions, we can arrive at some pretty sensible strictures for ourselves and this sort of thing. But that's because we are living out in this world of this and that, and the coming and going. So we need that. It's just that by recognizing that that actually isn't what's happening here, doesn't mean that we don't take care of this. Because otherwise, there'd be chaos and there's pain and sorrow and anger and everything, and all these other things just increase if we don't deal with the appearances. So I've pointed out many times that the enlightened, they don't deny the appearances. By deny, I mean not just say, well, there are no other. I mean, or to even live in a way as if the appearances aren't something here for us to deal with. They are. But why? Well, here's the moral aspect of it now that comes in. Is because in doing so, we can settle down. There's that word eudaimonia, which I haven't, but that's what the Greeks were after. But this is the way that you would come to it. But living is kind of like living a perfect life, a totally settled life, a life of true, deep, profound happiness and understanding, eudaimonia. But if you set that out there now as something you want to go out, you're never going to find it. You're just going to keep creating this world of pain and sorrow and havoc. How do we get out of this? We just see the true nature of what is taking place here. And yet at the same time, we take care of the appearances as well. We get a lot of ideas about the appearances, and then we start putting value and weighing these things about, this is good and that's bad, and we're starting to see things in this term. These terms, that's not helpful. That's a grounds for just stirring it all up again. rather than looking in terms of good and evil and good and bad, looking in terms of wholeness, or is it disharmony? Is it fractured? Is it divided? Movement. So that's why we have, like, in the Dhammapada, where the Buddha says, do that which is of the whole, and avoid that which is
unwholesome.
The unwholesome, yeah. But what would that be then? But that is of the fractured, the divided, the part, as opposed to the whole. No, you're showing favoritism. You could be very easily once we divided it, and well, this is better, or this is more like my kin, and showing favoritism. And that's just going to just start stirring things up again. If we are wise and actually see the true nature of what is unfolding here, we wouldn't behave this way. And when the Greeks who were searching for this eudaimonia, well, this is how you would find it. And it isn't like it's an object there to be found. It is right here. If you stop making everything difficult, we can certainly do this in our own personal lives. We can help others around us. You know, that maybe gradually we can begin to realize there's a different way of living here without thinking that everything is solid and real and needs to be straightened up. You know, we have all these ideas too about how we need to go out there and manage nature, manage the forests and all of these kinds of things. Well, yeah, maybe so, because we've messed them up so much, maybe there are some things that we need to do. But much of this stuff, leave it alone, it'll manage itself. I remember as a young man from northern Minnesota, and there was up on the north shore there in Lake Superior. Anyway, I was one time I really wanted to buy some property up there, and I met this fellow who, he did that, but it was a piece of property. He bought it really cheap because it had been ruined by people that lived on there, and they tore everything down or whatever, but the trees are all cut down and all sorts of things. It was just a mess of a piece of property. But he bought 40 acres really cheap. But he didn't do anything with it for like 20 years. Didn't even visit the property for like 40 years or 20, I forget how long. It was quite a stretch of time. Time enough for trees to start getting tall and that sort of thing. When he went back there, it was beautiful. You know, and then later in life, he built a cabin on it or something. But didn't manage it at all. The forest managed itself. Is coming out of the whole. The whole managed the forest. But we feel like we have to manage things. Well, in some ways, at this point, we've made such a mess of the oceans and the whatever else, and just our own, the way we try to rule ourselves, you know, our democracies and all this, the troubles that we're creating for ourselves, and some people want to even abandon all of this when, I think it would be a very foolish thing to do. But there's a limit to how much we can do with this managing. Yeah, there's some things that we need to take care of directly, yeah. So it isn't like let everything go. But to get in there and to feel like we can control everything, and we're doing it out of, well, what I would like, or I can make more money doing this, or this would, you know, be to our advantage here, back off on that kind of thinking. Somewhat. I don't say to end it. That's going too far. But anyway, we have gone over. Oh, yeah, Mary.
Given human intention, given this urge to get in there and do something and accomplish something for our own egotistic ends, how does one purify one's own mind? Just notice that.
Yeah, just watch your own mind. And also, if you can put your eye on the whole. And the way to, I describe this in my book, Buddhism Plain and Simple, the way to do this is just simply by watching your mind and noticing the inclinations of your mind, and just start to see that, to realize what that is and where that's coming from and what that might yield if, say, you could start making some headway. You're not going to get anywhere with that. Eventually you can see that as well. There's no point to really be driven by that at all. In any large-scale way, but even very much at all. And then allow the way that things are unfolding around us to show themselves, like that beautiful piece of land. It was getting more and more beautiful. And then to live accordingly. I would have hoped then that when that guy did move onto the land, he left a lot of the trees or whatever. He didn't make too big a disturbance there. Maybe build a little cabin or something. I don't know what he did, but anyway. But something like that. Wes Jackson down in Kansas. He's a great guy, but I don't have time to describe him. But he was a good friend of Wendell Berry. But anyway, his philosophy is, he's in agriculture, but he's in sustainable agriculture. But he said, basically his motto is, keep it small. Don't do any big grand thing, you know, where you just plow, you know, hundreds of acres or something and let it all wash into the Gulf of Mexico. Eventually that's what we'll have, or blow away in the air. But just keep everything small, and you know, don't try to be such a grandiose manager or that sort of thing. I really have to end it. We have gone over the hour, so I really should end it here. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.